Joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
Good morning. It is 7:59. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up, Voices from the Edge with our guest host, Rochelle Dixon. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. Heather McCoy at 10. At 11 on Between the Covers, Ken Jones talks with Karen Russell, author of the new book Orange World and Other Stories. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures, Zippy the Pinhead creator Bill Griffith recounts his long career from underground comics to graphic memoirs. It's 8 o'clock.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Patrick Kimmons Birthday Remembrance on Monday, June 17th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Southwest 4th Avenue and Harvey Milk Street in Portland. Patrick Kimmons was born on June 17th, 1991. This will be his birthday remembrance and protest of his murder by Portland police on September 30th, 2018. This event will have food, water, soda, coffee, candles, and opportunities to share memories of Patrick and organize against police violence. Again, that's Patrick Kimmons' birthday remembrance on Monday, June 17th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Southwest 4th Avenue and Harvey Milk Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts presenting Jim James of My Morning Jacket and the Claypool Lennon Delirium featuring Les Claypool and Sean Lennon. Thursday, June 27th. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a news and public affairs director to manage the evening news and public affairs programming and to train and supervise volunteers. For this full-time position, we're looking for someone with proven experience in news and public affairs production, management and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. People of color and women are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
Good morning. Good morning. This is Rochelle Dixon with Voices from the Edge, and I'm standing in hosting for Joanne Hardesty. And with me today, I have Kevin Fitz, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Kevin, and then I'm going to let Kevin tell you more about himself. So today we are going to be talking about mental health and politics, and Kevin is the director of executive director, let me get that right, the executive director of the Oregon Mental Health Consumer Association. So Kevin's going to be here with me today discussing politics, mental health, and a new bill coming out, new legislation called the Peer Respite Bill, HB 2831. So Kevin, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so Kevin, tell us a little bit more about your background. So you've been a consumer advocate. What else have you done?
So let me just say, although I've done media interviews, it's very rare that I do live interviews. So I'm kind of nervous, and so I think I'm going to talk about some things that make me kind of vulnerable, but let's get into it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to be here because I think it's important to hear from people who've been impacted by the subject, just not people who've been treating the subject.
Sure.
It's a little different.
Sure.
Challenge.
Just a 30-second thumbnail sketch of my bio. I was born into a family. I was the third child, 5.5 weeks premature. I came out of my mother's womb with epiglottitis, choking for air, suffocating basically at 0 days old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from that time, I was always hypersensitive to my environment and probably had a cloud of fearfulness of
mm-hmm.
my environment, and then moved into having a very alcoholic, functional, alcoholic, abusive father and a mother who had nervous issues due to father's infidelity, alcoholism, and verbal abuse. And so it was kind of mixed up, jumbled up childhood,
mm-hmm.
and got in got into my early teens and ended up with my alcoholic father having custody and became a feral teenager in places in Milwaukee and St. Louis. Got into a lot of juvenile delinquency. Of course, they said, you know, this is a mental health issue. Kevin has an emotional issue. He's repressing his anger over his parents' divorce, and got into forced counseling by the court mm-hmm. when they got custody. And then kind of straightened that out and found alcohol a way to deal with my pains. Fast forward into 1984, I was 19 years old, United States Army. I had a psychotic break. I was poisoned with a street drug called Angel Dust, or PCP. Had a psychotic break starting like April 3rd, 1984. It lasted 9 months. And the diagnosis was schizophrenia, brought on by drug induce.
My goodness.
So that turned my life and what I wanted to do and who I thought I was upside down. This is probably going to be heretical, but before I had my psychotic break, I wanted to be Calvin Klein. I wanted to be a fashion designer, or Donald Trump. I wanted to be a commercial real estate developer.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm glad you didn't turn out to be Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So, folks, this is a live show. And so you can give us a call in at 503-231-8187. Again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. So it's 1984. You've had this psychotic break due to the drug. And what's next?
So I come out here. I'm on the streets of Portland, 1984. End up staying at my sister's apartment, who's going to PSU, having tremendous delusions of persecution. Back then, it was the military trying to kill me. So I went AWOL, came out here, ended up getting in the community mental health system as 20, you know, kids are going to, you know, U of O kids are in frats, they're having fun, meeting women, planning their career. I'm in Damage State Hospital in Wilsonville, committed, saying, you have paranoid schizophrenia, you're never going to be able to live independently. So my life since then has been an intersection of three different things. One being a mental I don't mean this in a negative way, mm-hmm. but what the system, I'm a full-time mental patient in community services for people who with severe challenges, and then an advocate, a volunteer advocate, and a paid clinician. And so for the last 35 years, I have intersected doing those three things. Since my last psychotic breakdown of 10 years, I've been mostly doing volunteer systems advocacy and educating people about the system and the funds that we put into it in Oregon and Multnomah County.
Thanks for sharing that with us. And I don't want to shortchange you here, because I've been peeking at your bio and I see there's some things that you left out. Perhaps you're a little humble. So I'm going to go ahead and not be humble for you. So Kevin serves on the State of Oregon's Addiction and Mental Health Planning and Advisory Council, the State of Oregon's Consumer Advisory Council, the Multnomah County Mental Health and Addiction Services Advisory Council, the Coordinating Board for the Joint Office of Homeless Services, a Home for Everyone program, and the Oregon Mental Health Consumer and Psychiatric Survivor Coalition, also known as OCSC. So in your bio, you have a couple highlights of working at Mind Empowered, a consumer-run drop-in center in Southeast Portland. Tell us a little bit about that experience and how that shaped your opinions back then.
So through the 70s and the 80s, the federal government was starting to look at what do the people who have these diagnoses and how have they moved forward in their recovery and rehabilitation. And it launched what we call, for the last 34 years, the consumer movement of public mental health services, meaning the people who have been diagnosed and lived with these challenges come to the table and say, this is the road that, you know, and I liken it, and I don't mean to be insulting, but to the idea of what developed in the Catholics in the 60s in South America, liberation theology. And this is me, and I don't want to be disrespectful, but during some of the ages of slavery, they had what was an underground railroad to help get people to safety. The peer movement and mm-hmm. this engagement about individuals who have been diagnosed and lived with these disabilities, those are the way out of the swamp. Those are the way out of bureaucratic institutionalization and codependency in a very reduced state of sociability and friends. And that's where I work at now as a volunteer, trying to connect a lot of the hubs between the state and Chair Kefauri and Mayor Wheeler's budgets and the way they look at working with people who have been diagnosed with serious mental illness.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that explanation. And I want to just take a step back because I know a little bit, just a little bit, because you're the expert here, on mental health treatment. And I know that up until, you know, like the 1940s, it was totally inhumane, got a little less inhumane over time. But by the 1960s, people were still largely institutionalized. And then Kennedy decided that we should have mental health centers in each community. That sounded like a really good idea. It's probably still a really good idea, but it was left unfunded for the most part. So there wasn't a lot of success there. And then when the Reagan era came in, I believe he further left these budgets unfunded. And then we started to say, well, maybe we should institutionalize people. So we have a loss of money going into the mental health community for any kind of support services, and we have a loss of institutions. And what we see in Portland is anytime you go down the street, downtown, or get on a public bus, you'll see the results of that combination of things. So there aren't a lot of tools available to folks in the numbers that we need to address this situation. So as coming up here, I saw a guy eating a muffin on the street, and he really looked like he needed help. I don't know what his diagnosis would be, but clearly there was something that was not in this world that didn't understand what was going on around him. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what your thoughts are on when this situation became what I think is a crisis. Mm-hmm. When did it become a crisis? For each family, for each person going through it, we know it's an individual crisis. But I don't know how anyone can live in this city and not think that we need more funding for addiction services, that we need more funding for mental health, that we need more funding for houselessness, which does not help addiction or mental health treatment. What are your thoughts?
Okay, well, just one of the things, I think you're right, Kennedy's idea, all through the 40s and 50s, you'd see in Life magazine an expose of the horribleness of institutions, state hospitals, people in very deprived states, horrible conditions, and started the movement of, you're right, Kennedy and their administration moved forward with a community mental health investment idea that every place should, every county or region should have a county or a community mental health clinic. And well, didn't fund it, didn't mm-hmm. the vision didn't continue. But we had the apparatus and the the idea that we want one of these, but we have terribly underfunded them, and we continue to underfund them 60, 55 years later particularly. And the horrible sin the Reagan administration did is not only not increase this, but his discrimination of people with mental health disabilities and elderly people living in HUD housing, he completely like took a knife to the HUD budget for folks with disabilities and living in low-income housing, which exacerbated the problem because we didn't have enough community mental health funding clinics in the first place, and then it turbocharged it. You could see through the 90s. Move forward, all the West Coast, these boutique places that people want to go and have their craft brew and all that stuff bring in a tremendous amount of cultural interest. The problem is, and particularly with the disability and the mental health disability, there's a lot of folks, if you're crazy and you're rich, you're eccentric. If you're crazy and you're poor, you're diseased, broken, and get away from me. I think we are continually to underfund our community system, and we see it with the people wounded and suffering on street corners right in this core part of Southeast Portland.
You're right. And I do want to mention that this is a live show. You can give us a call at 503-231-817. We'll answer your questions. We'll take your thoughts, your remarks. And also, I want to remind you that at 9, we're going to have Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell. So it'll be her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. And at 10, the Heather McCoy Show will come on. So stay tuned. At 11, there's more stuff coming between the covers with host Ken Jones. He's going to talk with Karen Russell, who's the author of the new book, Orange World and Other Stories. So at 11:30, there will also be words and pictures with Zippy, the pinhead creator, Bill Griffith. who recounts his long career from underground comics to graphic memoirs. And don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO, including this one, on iTunes and Google Play. So all of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on donate. And I'm talking here with Kevin Fitz. And Kevin Fitz is talking about mental health and politics, and we're going to get into a specific bill a little bit later. But Kevin is the executive director of the Oregon Mental Health Consumer
Association.
Association. I was going to say Alliance. I don't know. That's what happens when you don't drink enough coffee. So it looks like we have a caller on the line. It's caller Jack. Jack, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning, Jack. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Kevin, I've heard you talk about your thoughts of importance that consumers be more involved directly with the mental health system, and you're going to be talking about the peer respites, which are run by peers themselves. Can you explain a little bit more about why that's important, why we can't just let the mental health professionals just do it for us?
Yeah, sure. Do you want to respond?
Well, I think that's a great question, Jack, so I'm going to let Kevin answer that question.
So let me just be frank. I mean, what I want, a revolution in mental health. I want the people to take control of the system and direct it to a system that helps people's needs. So I'm not just talking about making a dent here and 10% of your workforce being peers. I want the people who are running it, the bureaucrats and the CEOs and CFOs, I want those to all have people, if we're working in helping people with mental and emotional challenges, I want the people who run these NGOs and these government departments to have the experience of something like this. Because I think if they did, we'd have much more efficiency with our tax dollar, we would stop iatrogenically wounding people, and we would stop keeping people in cages and keeping them captive and giving them terrible ideas of brokenness, disease, or pathology of their mental and emotional wounds.
I think that's a great answer, Kevin. And just to expand on that, I think for most of them, most folks, including myself, we have a family member or someone who we're close to, a neighbor, a colleague, that has mental health challenges that we have to deal with and manage. And so there is a lack support system for that as well. It's really hard to be connected to someone who's schizophrenic or whatever and not have the support services there for you trying to assist this person. So I hear a lot of something that really confounds me, and I'm tempted to read what someone said on Facebook yesterday, but I won't expose you to that. But basically, the assumption is that if folks just got in shelters and they just got addiction treatment, and because we're assuming there's enough addiction treatment, we're assuming there's enough housing, and we're assuming there's enough mental health professionals. These are a lot of assumptions that I don't see. When I see folks seeking services, there's a lot of reaching out to the community, especially in the African American community, saying, who can I go to? Where can I get this help? And there isn't necessarily a wealth of information coming out there. And even doing the research, when folks are lining up for these services, it's months and months to get in. If somebody's having a breakdown right now, you know what folks are doing. What are folks doing when someone's having a mental health problem? Who's the first person they call?
The Portland Police.
That's right. Is that working for us, Kevin?
It hasn't historically worked very well at all.
No,
it hasn't. But I do give them credit to their awareness and consciousness of it, I think, has gone up. And although I think they're far from perfect, I think that there are some, you know, it's an institution and it's a political power, but I think there's some people within that apparatus understand we've got to stop killing folks mental and emotional disabilities.
Well, the police probably aren't the right person to call. I mean, they're not the right organization to call. I have a great amount of respect for the police who do their work. It's very dangerous, but they're not trained or qualified to deal with mental health situations. An unfortunate example in Clackamas is the story of Christopher Kalonji, who had a court date and over something minor, and unfortunately stressed out over that court date, just a very young man, and a teenager really, and decided that he was going to lock himself in a room, and subsequently went out on a out of a window, like on a balcony ledge type thing. Police were called, and what Christopher needed was mental health treatment, maybe a therapist, maybe someone who could help him out. He wasn't a danger to himself or to his family. He had never expressed any suicidal thoughts, but was just really scared. And what ended up happening is after the police were involved, this was in Clackamas, he was killed. The end. So we know that they're not the right people to call. We know that people who don't have experience in the mental health field are not the right people to call. And what I mean by experience, Kevin, I'm going to let you expand on this because I think we're on the same page on this, is I'm talking about some lived experience here, not the stuff you get out of the book, because I love the stuff that's in the book, but the book has led us into some unfortunate places. We need some people who can inform what scientists study in a lab so that it can apply in our homes, our community, and our streets. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't want to be hardcore on the people who don't have any street smarts and are easily manipulated because they don't have much investigation of their own emotional processes. I mean, we need the academics and the writers and, you know, the smart people and that. But dealing with people who have nervous, odd, and awkward challenges takes, I think, some courage of looking in towards your own inner storm. I want to ask you a question. You talked about a relative who was challenged and have, you know, around the schizophrenia issue. How many years, I don't know if you drive a Porsche or a BMW, it's hard to tell by your fashion sense, but how many years would you take your Porsche into the same mechanic and get failure after failure after failure after failure, and then finally you take it to a new mechanic and said, you know, you must have treated this car terribly because it's in horrible shape. He said, wait a second. I was a fabulous self-maintenance. It was the mechanic that effed it all up. The same challenge. How many times would you take your kid, your daughter, your sister, your spouse to Multnomah County Mental Health and saying, he's got terrible methamphetamine addictions. He's got suicide impulsivity. He's getting kicked out of his SRO because he's talking to voices or picking fights. How many times did you take him to the door of Multnomah County Mental Health and say, oh, well, I took him here last week. You failed again. What, I mean, it's. I think it's analogous to the mechanic failing you all again and then blaming it on you, the driver. And the same thing with our mental health system. How many times, what is the fragility, the vulnerability, the crack in the egg every time you go to a failed treatment engagement? And so here, I'm going to ask you a question about the theory about self-regulation or co-regulation, particularly with mothers and infants, and what that has to do with all these people on the streets that are giving us emotional reactions and where we go with that.
Okay, go ahead.
So here's the question. There was a study done, I think it was by University of Pennsylvania. They took mothers and they took their kids and they said, okay, mothers, it's called the still face experiment. So you're cooing, making loving eyes at your children. For some period of time, we're going to say, mother, still face. Don't show any emotion. Don't smile. Don't, you know, whatever. Be completely distant in the face. So they studied the infant's response. So before the mother put on her still face, they were co-regulating. Mom's looking at you. I'm beaming in. I trust this being, blah, blah, blah. But when mother went into still face, the child looks around for other, you know, primary objects to connect with maternally And there's nothing there, so they have to go into self-regulation. So self-regulation, when you're not completely developed, is very traumatizing, especially when you're still like, oh, I thought the umbilical cord exists. So you go through that over and over again. So fast forward, so we all have that co-regulation, self-regulation. Mm-hmm. I see you, you're either friend or foe, and I have a sympathetic reaction to that. But so here's the experience. We see these people in high sympathetic, over-aroused, autonomic breakdowns. We have two responses. You're not new. It's not. You can't be neutral in a moving train. You either move towards the, mm-hmm. the wound to put a Band-Aid on it or to give some companion, or you block yourself off of the emotional affect to not be influenced and not to feel their pain. So there's no like, there's no stasis. You're either moving away and withdrawing because you find it a threat. So there's so many people on streets who are looking for some co-regulation, and all they get is side eyes and disgusting sneers from particularly some of our younger and more cruel members of our society. Where do we go when so many people have walled off the suffering, the mental and emotional suffering of those people who are suffering on our streets with these terrible pains and wounds?
That is a good question. I know one thing is wherever we're going is going to cost money. We have to invest in our communities if we want a healthy community. If we're fine with what we're seeing on the street today going exponentially up, then we don't have to worry about it. We definitely don't have to worry about it. But if you're concerned about your own well-being, the well-being of your neighbors and your community, then we definitely have to do something, because I don't see this changing. What I see is a loss of services having led to many people not having any resources to turn to. Some folks are not even from here. They don't have familial resources. A lot of families are just at their wit's end, don't know what to do. The mental health community really needs the funding and the support services. There was a study that came out about housing and how losing housing causes mental health challenges. What do you know about that, Kevin?
Well, so, I mean, you can't tell it by looking at me, but I have been asked to move, politely, informally evicted from 5 different places. Why? Because Kevin had a psychotic, during his 10 and 12 years of psychotic break in his midlife, he was not a very polite or, apartment rule of obeyer. So I moved 5 times, waiting to get on low income housing. I was staying at Residence Inns in Hillsboro and in Gresham, and my rental record was terrible. And so it's a particular challenge. The challenge, if you think of the world between inner and outer, or sympathetic and parasympathetic, it is much more safer to have an experience of a psychotic breakdown if you're in your nest or in the womb or someplace that's dependable and safe that you can go back to, mm-hmm. in your tent. But if you're out in the concrete jungle and there's no place to go lick your wounds, so to speak, or to patch up the crack in your egg, it compounds your vigilance, your hypervigilance, a turbocharged warrior on steroids. It's bad news for the rest of the citizens, and it's bad to be in that extended state of rage, paranoia, and deep fear, and no retreat. So it's like being on a war, emotional war zone with no love. Ain't a whole lot of, I mean, you and I probably smile and give a person a dollar or give them a street roots to say, here's a directory. But there's other folks that are disgusted. Chair Kefouri did a town hall in the Foster Powell area, uh-huh. about we need a family shelter.
I know.
They needed to be escorted out by security, because half of the crowd were full, working class crowd, albeit, were full of ideas of these disgusting zombies on our streets. And it was like, oh my, these are our brothers and sisters.
So. You know, I'm going to elaborate on that a little bit later, but we have a caller on the line. It's Drew. Drew, are you with us?
Yes, how are you today?
I'm fine, Drew. Thank you for calling in. What's your question?
Good. Well, my background's in industrial organizational psychology, and I have a lot of I think you're onto something about mental health and homeless people. The problem is that they canceled the mental health programs 20 years ago. They closed the hospitals. We've actually, started to get a culture of you're on your own. that's how it is. And despite the fact that the Republicans aren't cutting, you know, the cuts yet, they're doing it mentally, and they're living, making people feel that there's not enough resources in the world, and we don't come at it from abundance. So I think you're right. I think homeless people first and foremost need to be recognized as sovereign individuals on the earth, and I think we need to teach that in the schools. We need to teach that to people, and we need to teach that right now by talking on the radio. But we need to, everybody who's listening on the radio needs to speak up more often to homeless people, listen to them. When I buy a street roots, I ask them if there's anything that they wrote in it, and they go, well, one gentleman said, no, I don't poem. And I said, no, he's poem as a verb. And I said, you do poem. And we kind of talked about that for a while. And I think that's just what people need to realize, first and foremost. And secondly, we need to start giving our resources to them. I'm not sure where all this giant Democratic money is. I know it goes into elections. I wish it would go into things to solve problems like this. Yeah. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Well, great. Drew, thank you so much for calling in. And I want to point out that Drew said we've got a poverty mentality. And I agree. So I said, that there might not be enough resources. And what I really wanted to say was what Drew said. We're not putting our resources in the right place. I think that's a better thing to say. And I want to read something here. I said I wasn't going to read it, and I changed my mind. So here we go. So this is a comment on Facebook in a group that I'm in, and it's talking about housing. And someone decides that they're going to go out and photograph some folks that are on the street. And I'm like, hey, that's not really so cool, especially when you're showing faces. We can get the point without you taking the photos. And recently I tried to take a photo of a dog. The dog was just so cute. It was just like, he looked like a table. I don't know what this dog was eating. But I asked if I could take a picture of the dog, and I compensated the person for the picture, for the talent, the dog. It was such a sweet little pit bull. And the owner jumped into the picture. And I was like, oh, that's not kind of what I meant. I just want to take a picture of the dog. But hey, it's cool taking a picture of you. And he was just really proud to show off what he had. And I realized he wasn't having those normal human interactions as much as other folks do. So took the picture and explained to people that I did get his permission and actually compensated him for it. But this is what came off of Facebook, and I got into a discussion, not an argument, but just a discussion. So here's the comments. We're talking about houselessness, and the person posts the pictures. There's about 25 pictures, and this person responds back. Unless you want to legally compel people to take their prescriptions and submit to some form of shelter living, this problem is only going to get worse. Now, my issue is submit. I don't know what it means to be to submit to some form of shelter. It sounds like to me we're talking about maybe going back to institutionalizing folks, because we didn't say make it available, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So
I just asked the NATO family what they think about Japanese internment camps.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting subject. I want to hear more on that later. So a couple folks respond back, and they're like, ooh, that's, you know, not everyone on the street is drug addicted. A lot of people are seniors. A lot of people are disabled. And there are some people who are addicted and, of course, mental health problems. And this person responds back to the privacy issue by saying, maybe you don't deserve privacy if you are sleeping and blanking and leaving your needles in the entryway to my building every night. What about my rights to not have to hose off the vomit and urine and human feces every day while endangering my life picking up your needles? I'm so blank tired hearing about the rights of the homeless. I have rights too. You're not my child, and I should not have my property damaged every single day because you think it's okay to defecate and shoot up in my doorway. Maybe people would show more empathy for the homeless campers if they policed themselves and cleaned up some of their own needles and feces. But in today's Portland, that would be asking too much. Now, I have a caller on the line, Dennis, but before I go to Dennis, I want to say, remember those words, because we want to come back to them. That is what people are thinking. Now, in case you think that that is some uneducated nobody, so to speak, no, this is someone who should actually no better than all the things they looped in, that knows Portland extremely well, knows the city budget extremely well, knows development extremely well, and the housing crisis. So we're going to go to Dennis right now.
It'd be interesting to know, you know, what that person's emotional life is.
Sure, like, sure. So Dennis, you're on the line.
A lot of intolerance going on.
Hello?
Hello, Dennis. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Listen,
good.
I have a comment. I used to live in Santa Cruz, California, and there they have a homeless and a mental health issues. Of course, it's a smaller community than Portland, but they definitely have the mental health issues. And quite a while ago, I guess I would say about 20 years ago, the mental health people themselves formed an organization which they called, now get this, Mental Health Client Action Network, or MHCAN. And they formed this unit, and they got a place to meet. The idea was there was a central place for all of them to meet, and it was this advertised thing. This was long before Facebook. And they got a place to meet in the community where they could have, you know, some food, and they could meet and talk to each other, and so on. And then from time to time, they would reach out to doctors in the community, to people who were trained, to come to them and give lectures and treat them. Okay, and so this is, I thought that was an interesting idea. I still do, and my family. I was in this, and my family contributed to it, and I hope they still do. You know, they make contributions to this organization. I was wondering if there was anything like this, if you'd heard about anything like this. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I'm going to let Kevin take that question, because I think he knows best, and he can share with you.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's fantastic. I've been at this since the mid-80s, so I knew folks down there in Santa Cruz, still do. There's a fantastic peer respite project down there. If you Google, it's called Second Story. So it's run by consumers, by peers, a non-medicalized facility for people at an intermediate level of psychiatric crisis or trauma. It's a fantastic organization and a great house, and has a great loving community around it. What you're referring to is what the federal government started piloting in the mid-80s called drop-in centers for community. Started out of a book by an author named Judy Chamberlain called On Our Own, saying, let us nurse our own wounds and build community healing. Stop the helicopter parent authority figure telling us what's the matter with us without listening to what we need. So it spawned the consumer movement and the drop-in center movement up and down the West Coast, from Berkeley, California, to Vancouver, to Portland, Oregon. And we mentioned it at the beginning of the show. One of those pilot projects in 1988 was called the Mind Empowered, right up here on 26th and Southeast Belmont. For almost 6 years, mental health consumers and people, psychiatric survivors, ran a community mental health drop-in center that was nonviolent, non-coercive, and accepting and non-judgmental of anybody. The only rules was you couldn't bring your weapons in, and you couldn't physically assault people. The rest of that we would manage and learn to build a community. It was thriving. Probably 200 to 250 different folks a month would come through that place. People from group homes, people from the institutions, young kids living in the Lone Fir Cemetery who had escaped, you know, difficult family places. So yeah, the drop-in center community. I was in charge of a grant under Governor Kitzhaber. At the end of my work, we had 25 consumer-run drop-in centers around the state of Oregon. We have one quarter of that now, particularly. We're spending so much money on pharmaceutical drugs and hospitalization costs, we are starving our community budget. $5 billion a year, but an awful lot of that goes to our hospital systems and our pharmaceuticals. What we need to lead is community friendship and build some place of repetitive trust based, you know, and bring people into a community. Loneliness is killing an awful lot of people, but the people with these challenges, it's even double because they have very few friends and people that they can trust. And so that's why it's so crucial to ask your lawmakers, what are we doing for the community? And what are we doing for people who need a safe space with another fellow traveler? They have it at, you know, it's rumored that at a Grateful Dead concert in Autzen Stadium in 72 or 73, that the White Bird Clinic folks would walk around as trained as volunteers to help people who are having an acid breakdown.
Yes, and that still continues today. You can volunteer as a paramedic for concerts. I thought it was Grateful Dead that started it.
Yeah,
but
So
you can get medical treatment at a concert if you take a drug and have a bad experience. And now it's a little bit more formalized, but yeah.
There's a project called Zendo that does it every year at Burning Man. We need to be able to have peers who go through such training, how to reach out and to respond with kindness and love to a person in a psychotic situation.
Oh, now we have to get back to that statement that I read. I want to mention that this is a live show. It's 503-231-8187. So call in with your questions or thoughts, 503-231-8187. And I want to also tell you that at 9 o'clock, we're coming up on Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, who'll take a weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. So stay tuned for that. At 10, it'll be the Heather McCoy Show. And 11, Between the Covers with host Ken Jones, and he's going to be with author Karen Russell. And 11:30, Words and Pictures with Zippy the Pinhead creator Bill Griffith. So don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes or Google Play. So if you miss parts of this or just want to go back and listen to parts of it, you can always hear it in an archive. So I read a statement from Facebook, and it said, I'm tired of hearing about the rights of the homeless. What about my right to not have to hose down bodily fluids? And what do you make from that statement that I read you?
Well, so if you're leaving me behind, if you're closing your heart off to me, how long did it take for you to get there, and how far away are you from your heart and your acceptance of me being your fellow neighbor or brother or sister on planet Earth? Where sounds like this person has either grown to or was born with a tremendous amount of intolerance for people who have have not had the fortune, luck, or ability, you know, or talent to keep them from poverty, to keep them from houselessness. The solution is not to take the fire hose on the homeless person in your driveway and cuss them out and make them feel ashamed of themselves. I mean, they're wounded and they're, you know, and their psyche is all over the place. And what they need is some sense of compassion and some sense of ritualized sense of safety and trust. And putting a butterfly net over them and stuffing them in a cage or in a 200-person shelter is just going to make their inner animal either go numb because fear or get enraged. It's not, there's no love to be had in the institution. It's just, you know.
My concern is if you have a thought process like that, you don't fund the programs because you think that the people who are in that situation should have all the solutions themselves. And I think that's highly problematic when we assume that the people who are on the street have all of the structures in place, the mental health capacity, the intellectual capacity, that they're not drug addicted and they can put these things in place. People, we're community members. We need to vote for resources to put into these communities. How long was the mental health community starved before this happened? So we have a couple callers on the line. So LJ, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning, LJ.
And
thanks for calling
in.
Thanks
for coming on the show.
You're
all
welcome.
Do you mind if I dredge up the past and talk about James Jaffe?
Oh, sure. Go right ahead.
All right. James Jaffe, who was murdered by the Portland Police Bureau, has a history of like mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe he was murdered by the Portland Police for urinating on a building. Yes. I'm almost certain.
Yeah.
And obviously nothing happened to the Portland Police. I understand he was choked to death. And they also broke several of his ribs because they ran after him and tackled him, which is obviously not according to the manual. And so I'm just wondering if the Portland Police has a unit now that takes care of situations with people who have mental breakdowns so they don't have to face being murdered.
Sure,
and
thank
I'll
you.
I'll take my responses off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in, LJ. I also want to mention that for folks who don't know the story of James Chancey, there is a movie, a documentary that you can watch. It's called Alien Boy. And so look that up, Alien Boy, and you'll be able to learn the history of what happened there. And Jason Renaud was involved in that project and is also local. So a very local story, a very important story, very telling that today we're dealing with much the same issue as what happened in that situation with James Chancey. So I appreciate you calling in, LJ. And we're going to run right into this next caller. Deanna, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just was pretty impressed with that statement that you read for two reasons. One, actually, I can sympathize with the, not wanting to have to do those things. But the person has blamed the wrong people for the problem. Certainly, it is not the problem created by homelessness, but by we citizens who have money, privilege, power, responsibility to vote for the money to end this crisis. So that person should, I think, take a look in the mirror.
Thank you so much for that comment, Deanna, and I have to tend to agree to you. A little later on, I do want to say that in one of the comments that person made in Facebook was to read the Riot Act to some of the city officials about not putting the money in the right place. So I think I think he got that right. It's just unfortunate the vitriol that comes out and not instead of compassion, because I really want to know. I'm a liberal. I'm a liberal all day long. But I'll tell you something. I'm working on feeding the homeless and paying out of my own pocketbook. And I just want to know, where is the money going?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Where is the money going? If I can do it off the little bit of money that I have, and if I can feed 40 people a week, my God, they have the resources to feed 4,000, and we're doing this through a network of volunteers. Volunteers are providing the food, they're providing the labor. Something is wrong. We're not using our money wisely. So in that way, I am fiscally conservative. I want to see where my money is going, and I want to see where it's being effective. So I'm going to go back to you, Kevin, because the question was asked by
So one LJ. Of the here's one of the things that we, so I'm a volunteer with a volunteer policy group called the Oregon Mental Health Consumer Association. And what we've been doing all winter and into the spring is doing public records requests. And this is, I'm so glad you brought this up, because yes, we need more funding for community mental health services, but we also need to look at, if we have been buying 50 pounds of meatloaf for the last 20 years, I want you to ask, should we buy 10 pounds of meatloaf and then serve shrimp the rest of the time? We need a closer oversight. I liken myself in the Mad Persons Movement to half Ralph Nader and half Howard Stern, just because I have a quirky sense of humor. Mm-hmm. But the question that we should be asking is, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars here.
You got it.
Are we hitting the target? Are we creating poverty, very wealthy CEOs on top of these homeless agencies that are making $200,000, $300,000 a year, where they can't even pay their front-end staff enough money to live here? So we got to look at where the cash flow is going, not only adding to the cash flow.
Sure.
And they're taxpayers, so they should be chiseling into these questions.
That's right. We've got to be more fiscally responsible with what we do have. So we have two calls on the phone right now. Joe?
Hi.
Hello, Joe.
I just want to say, I felt like that Facebook post, I wasn't hearing a lot of vitriol in it. I was just feeling like, that's a human being that does not want to deal with someone's feces and dirty needles. I've been homeless. I never was using people's walkways for a bathroom or shooting up there. I'm just saying, you know, we're human. We can take so much. Who are we supposed to call? And I think this is a worldwide problem. We're going to need a whole restructuring of our lives to deal with this.
Yep.
Anyway.
I
do agree, Joe, that I do feel the frustration of the person in the Facebook post, and I didn't read it all, but I also felt like the person who was very well educated had misplaced the blame. Later on, they did in fact come around to the fact that we need a political solution and the political will to solve the problem. Until people actually get angry like him, and tell people like him get angry, there's going to be no change.
Yeah.
Because the people on the street aren't the best people to advocate for the money to make these changes. What happens when they try and advocate for the money? They oftentimes get told that they don't know enough, they don't have a PhD, that they don't know what they're talking about, that the certain amount of this community is just not for them, that they shouldn't expect that, that they shouldn't expect better. But the truth is that we should all want better. We should all expect better. No, I don't want to hose feces off the sidewalk either. I don't want to pick up needles. I asked this person, is the answer more bathrooms? Is the answer more needle collection boxes? And the person came back and said, no, I don't want to pay for those things. I want housing, but I don't want to pay for needle collection boxes, and I don't want to pay for bathrooms. And what I took from that was the person doesn't want temporary solutions. I get that. I think they want permanent solutions. But, Joe, I've got another caller on the line, so thank you so much.
Can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
One more thing.
Uh-huh.
We can't deny that there is a criminal element on the street, and, you know, we have to address that, too. You know, I live in Eugene. There's chop shops and people steal bicycles and they're doing chop shops in the park. I don't feel safe walking through the park. And, you know, we have to be real. Anyway, thanks for taking the call. Bye.
Thank you for calling in, Joe. I do want to address that while there is drug use on the street and there is crime on the street, there is definitely drug use behind closed doors for folks. There's definitely crimes being committed. And
everywhere you find humans, you find criminals. What, you know, 1% of the human race is born to be criminals and probably never shake it. 10% can be influenced and seduced into it, whether it's rich or poor or whatever, wherever you're going to find criminals. But the answer is poking again is, what are we spending on jail beds? What are we spending on hospitalization and pharmaceuticals? How can we build some community of healing instead of oppressing?
Exactly.
If someone craps in my driveway, I'm going to be exasperated and probably angry. That's natural.
Sure.
But also, like you said, get woke up to this and start talking your legislature or
exactly.
The county commissioners where the money's going.
So we're going to take one more call here, and then we're going to go to Kevin so Kevin can tell us about this upcoming bill and what he thinks about that and how potentially we can support it. So Mike, you're on the line.
Yes, good morning. Thank
good
you.
Good morning.
I appreciate your big picture looking at this, and this is a problem of colonialism and industrialization and everything else.
Yeah.
It's horrifying. I do want to correct something in terms of the police situation with the James Chassis situation. And there are, you know, as much as it's too little too late, there are some trainings going on of police officers by mental health experts, including people with lived experience.
Yeah, I know. Yes.
So
yeah. No one would debate that.
That.
No. Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Certainly. And they've. And I have, like I said, I know I have relationships with longstanding police officers over the last 30 years, and there has been, you know, the lawsuit where they sued the police for some of these things, and it has wakened up some of their consciousness. But, you know, there is also the sense of ask police officers. They are frustrated as heck that we have, you know, one place to go or two places to go and nothing else scaled down beyond that for people in psychiatric and crisis. And there's no place. Why so many people are suffering from an intersection between methamphetamine abuse, homelessness, and psychotic break. And we don't have a specialized treatment center. You can ask Central City Concern. There, nobody in the state of Oregon has a specific methamphetamine. You've damaged your neurobiology. You need 9 months, 18 months, someplace to build your brain cells back and come back down to earth. We don't have anything like that. And so many, we talk about opiates and heroin and alcoholism. Yeah. There's so many people, you look and watch them on hot days on street corners, suffering from methamphetamine psychosis. And even though we're going to be spending $250 million here in Multnomah County in mental health, where are the treatment centers for these people with these particular intersections of challenges? Let's ask about that.
Even that is a Band-Aid approach. I mean, what we really need is more prevention, not treatment. We really have to have a more equitable society, housing, and like you say, compassion.
I agree that
is a Band-Aid approach.
I agree. I think we need a cultural and revolution the way that we base our economy and our societies. Yeah. I agree with that. I agree.
Kevin, I'm going to jump in here and say, Mike, we need a Band-Aid and we need a long-term solution. So if
Absolutely.
You came to the hospital and you were bleeding, I'd want to find out where you're bleeding, what the issue is. But first, I'd want to take care of your immediate problem, and I might have to use a tourniquet. So thank you so much for calling
it's not
in,
either
Mike.
Or. Exactly. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
It's and. Thank you for calling in. And I'm going to talk with Kevin right now. So, Kevin, we talked a lot about a peer respite program.
Right.
And there is this great bill coming up. I've heard it's great. So tell us about it.
So we have 2 weeks left with the Oregon lawmakers looking at bills. We have a bill called HB 2831, Peer Respite. And it's an intermediate voluntary place for 7 to 10 days that individuals suffering from mental and emotional difficulties can go voluntarily and get psychological and emotional support and information and referral and resources to help them through a storm that's going on in their mind and soul, but may not need to be locked in a legacy Unity psych ward or Providence. Because they're not at that level, but they need some comfort and companionship through the 7 to 10 day storm of the initial, you know, challenges with their psychotic or their breakdown issues. And so we are saying to the state of Oregon, look, 15 other states are doing it. There's 40 of them that exist across the United States. Mental health systems are saying we need something else beyond intensive case manager at your house during the day and the locked hospital psych ward, which is sterile, inhumane, and unfriendly, some intermediate. And like I talked about Second Story in Santa Cruz, that's what we're trying to do to the state legislature. We spend $3 billion a year of taxpayers' money in Oregon on mental health. We're saying spend $2 million and pilot these three homes for people who are voluntarily and want to go get some psychological and emotional support. That's what the peer respite movement is about. And I liken it to liberation theology and the Underground Railroad. We need a relief valve to the trifecta of the homelessness, the jail, and the psych ward, and this recycling that. And the relieving that pressure is introducing people to community of acceptance. I've been there. I know what it's like. And also, too, I know that the dominant system may have hurt you in treating you like a piece of cattle or just somebody, a pill taker. Mm-hmm. So we think the leading edge of revolution is how do we treat people who are in the whole issue of therapeutic engagement. If my egg is cracked, how do you, Rochelle, as a mother, as a sister, as a friend, a community, how do you respond to me with a butterfly net and a Thorazine shot in my butt and then treat me and then chain me in a cage and lock me down with leather restraints? You know, my monkey, it goes berserker or shuts down. And what is the trauma that the system does to me in trying to contain me from public safety risk, but damages me emotionally.
Mm-hmm. And also damages the potential for that person going back in treatment. So I hear a lot of people saying, well, this person should go into a shelter. They shouldn't be lying on the street. That really sounds good. Have you been in a shelter? Some are better than others. Some folks go into shelters and unfortunately they're assaulted. Some folks go into shelters and they have things stolen. So some people feel a little bit more secure on the street. I think that's unfortunate, but we can build a better system than the one we have. We need to have the money at the right space. So
yeah, there's an entrepreneurship growing, and it's called the temporary shelter industry in Portland. So for the funds at the top, it can be very well paid.
But what we need is one more minute.
We need long-term housing and supportive care for folks in long-term housing.
How do we support that bill?
Well, Google HB 2831. So we need everybody and anybody to reach out to Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. She is one of the top of the Ways and Means Committee, and the decision to fund this bill exists with Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, and we are in her district. If you are in Old Town Portland, where an awful lot of these people are suffering, so let's try to get her attention. Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, she is a senator, and she is head of the Ways and Means Committee over health. And we have, the time is closing. HB 2831. Even if the bill doesn't pass, let's talk about therapeutic engagement and meeting people with a kindness and a warmth towards their wound or their pains instead of treating them like diseased cattle.
So email, write a postcard.
Yeah,
phone
or call.
Call.
Yeah. Best to call. Just Google Elizabeth Steiner Hayward and call her office and say, please support HB 2831. We believe what Kevin and Rochelle and community members believe in. We think this makes sense.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Kevin. That's all we have time for today.
Thank you very much.
Very interesting conversation. We could go on here for hours, but we're out of time. So this, you've been listening to KBOO Radio. This is Rochelle Dixon and Kevin Fitz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good morning, it's 8:59. This is KBOO Portland coming up at 9, just a couple of minutes away. Teresa Mitchell with her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, it's the Heather McCoy Show. And then at 11, between the covers, host Ken Jones talks with Karen Russell, author of the new book Orange World and Other Stories. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. Zippy the Pinhead creator Bill Griffith recounts his long career from underground comics to graphic memoirs. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.FM or use your mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall in Vancouver, Washington. The theme of the 7th annual Juneteenth celebration is Together We Rise. This theme addresses the idea that together we rise above the fray of hatred, despair, and discord. The celebration features a job fair, panels, awards, contests, an art gallery, live entertainment, and more. Again, that's the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.